And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. I want you to be able to really focus on these very exceptional people. And there seem to be no end to how many wonderful women today are writing books. Today on the podcast, another exceptional woman. Her name is Carrie Gress. She's a fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based think tank Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's a scholar at the Institute for Human Ecology. She's a doctorate in philosophy. She's the editor at the online woman's magazine Theology of Home. She's the author of 10 books. And I am really excited about a book that my son David put into my hands and said, Dad, you have to read this book. It's titled The End of Woman. I mean, this is an intriguing title, The End of Woman. It's subtitled How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. And in this book, I don't usually read from the flap cover of a book, but I do want to read a few excerpts from the inside front and inside back cover flaps. Feminism doesn't empower women. I mean, that's an incredible statement because most people, when they hear the word feminism, they hear it through a very positive filter or lens. But Carrie says that feminism doesn't empower women, it erases women. After 50 years of radical feminism, we can't even define woman. Feminism has served to abolish women. And then this sentence, hulking trans women are trashing female athletes. Women are aborting their baby girls. Drag queens are now performing obscene parodies of women. And still feminists cling to their illusions of liberation. Carrie Gress is a wife, she's a mother, she's a philosopher, and she, in this book, The End of Woman, she punctures the myth of feminism. And she says that only a rediscovery of true womanhood can pull our society back from the brink. For feminism's victims, Gress is a welcoming voice in the darkness as she answers the quintessential question, who is responsible for murdering the wonder of womanhood? Carrie, I am truly honored to have you on the podcast. You know, I always tell people you have to read a book three times to really own the material. And the way I do it, and I repeat this not to draw attention to myself, but I hope people get into this habit. The first time I read through a book, I sort of speed read it. The second time, I underline it with a Pentel. And third time, I use a highlighter. And that's the way I own the material. And I got this from C.S. Lewis. He said, you have to read a book three times to really master its contents. But this is a book that's really worth mastering, and it's a timely book. And I am just delighted and proud to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, goodness. Well, thank you. I'm really moved by your introduction. So I really appreciate being here.
Well, you're absolutely amazing. You talk about the vulnerability of women. I want you to elaborate on that to begin the podcast.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful place to start because, you know, this is one of the things that we've really glossed over in the culture is this idea of what happens when a woman becomes pregnant and just the radical vulnerability that is associated with that, both, you know, during the time while she's pregnant, but then also certainly after the child is delivered. And, you know, this has been what I think what feminism has really tried to eradicate is any kind of what, you know, perceived weakness. But you can see, you know, really in God's plan, the beauty of this, that there's the woman becomes vulnerable and, you know, together she and the child have to be taken care of. And just the beauty of the husband and the extended family and all of these different ways in which people have to give of themselves in order for a family and a community to flourish. And so I think that, you know, the earliest question that feminists were asking, because they saw the vulnerability as a real problem. And, you know, to their credit, this was a major concern. You had, you know, 1 in 20 women died from childbirth. I mean, there were some serious things. There's obviously abuse and all of those kinds of things. But, you know, to have the solution be that we need to make women like men, instead of saying, how do we help women in this vulnerable situation become better women? That's really what the beginning of the end and really where they started the movement off and just progressed forward. So we can see how, you know, just this effort to erase that vulnerability is what we're left with today. And just this idea that women aren't supposed to be fertile. And, you know, along with that goes, of course, the family and that tender relationship between mother and child and, you know, all of those aspects of the family that are so vital for any, you know, flourishing culture.
How many women do you think, maybe it's hard to give an exact statistic here, but how many women realize that they have been sold a bill of goods when it's just too late?
Oh, I think so many, so many. I mean, obviously, I don't have statistics. I just know more from my personal experience of women telling me, you know, a sort of horror and tragedy in terms of, you know, they can't go back and change things. And I know for a long time, I bought into it in terms of, what is it that I'm supposed to be doing to be considered a successful woman in the culture today? And, you know, if I finally gratefully had the realization that the things that I was doing were actually working against me, and especially when it came to relationships with men and, you know, the kind of ambition that we're told to have and being outspoken and sharp tongued and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And I just saw the negative fruit in my life. And I think, but there's so many of us that just, we don't know an alternate view. And that's the real harm that's been done in the culture, is that most women have no idea how much they've been brainwashed into thinking right along step with the feminist ideology that's so pervasive today.
Titles are always fascinating to me. The End of Woman, it's one of those titles that captures your imagination immediately. The subtitle as well, I'd like you to elaborate on both.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start with the subtitle. That actually came to me first, because I was really trying to just capture what is it that has happened. And that, you know, this realization that the whole focus, I mean, if you go to a women's march, it's all about the patriarchy. You know, that you can buy products that talk about ending the patriarchy and the future is female and all of this kind of propaganda. And that seems to be an incredibly pithy way to communicate what it is that they are trying to communicate. And, you know, we certainly see this in the new Barbie film. I mean, it's hugely successful, but embedded in that is that the doctrine of getting rid of the patriarchy. So, but what I wanted to communicate was just that we have done this to ourselves, that this has sort of been this sort of self-implosion that has happened. But the title itself, I mean, this was a work in progress for quite a while with the publisher, but I think, you know, is it also just this realization, this is what's happening, is women are being erased. And how do we communicate that, you know, that this is happening on a grand scale? So I just feel really grateful that we were able to come up with both a title and a subtitle that I think communicates a lot. The cover, of course, was another really important piece. And that actually happened almost the last few days before it was going to the publisher. We came up with a new cover. So anyway, it was just really beautiful to see how all of these pieces came together to communicate, you know, what you want to communicate in a book, because that obviously doesn't always happen, I think, for authors.
So what happens if the patriarchy disappears?
Yeah, well, I think we're seeing that. I think what we're seeing is the goal in the 1970s was really to try and break down the family through the use of creating immorality in the culture. So Kate Millett, who's, you know, was one of a very radical feminist. She wrote the book Sexual Politics. She was on the front cover of Time magazine. Kate had this idea based on the Frankfurt School and, you know, all these earlier leftists and Marxists, that if women could promote things like homosexuality, promiscuity, prostitution, you know, all of these kinds of things, that that really takes away any kind of power that a man has over his family. It takes away his voice. It really undermines it. And we can see echoes of this in the culture today, where schools are targeting children and, you know, circumventing the parents. So that was a very focused effort. And I think what we've seen is men don't know how to react in this culture. They don't know how to behave. They don't know how to treat women. You know, I think so many feel very threatened by kind of this verbal bandsaw that they're afraid to walk into with any kind of discussion about feminism. So as a result, they just sort of throw their hands up and just give up entirely. And I don't fault men for that. I mean, I think that's another thing that I really wanted to do with this book, was give men a place where they weren't blamed and, you know, could actually start navigating these issues and think through them carefully without, you know, feeling like they had to feel guilty by the time they were done with the book. So I think what we are seeing is just this suppression really of the masculine in ways that are, you know, incredibly unhealthy and so damaging because it creates this kind of dual resentment. I mean, women already have this built-in resentment because feminism has told us we're victims. And men are really experiencing firsthand, whether it's in their own relationships or their place of work or in the culture, you know, this kind of prejudice and that they're oppressors and they have to be put down. And so this mutual resentment wedge between the sexes is obviously not good for anybody and is creating so much discord in, you know, all families, but also places of work. And I think men have really been silenced by it.
What is the significance of our inability in Western culture to even define what a woman is?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because part of it is it's just political. You know, the idea of, I mean, the real definition of woman, obviously the short definition is, you know, adult female human. And the longer one, I think, involves discussion about motherhood, which I think extends not just to biological motherhood, but women are meant to be psychological and spiritual mothers to those around them as well. So I think the real fear is that if you define a woman, then you're automatically excluding those who might be trans or those who think that they're a woman. And that's the real taboo that has come out of this. And, you know, the feminist movement since the 70s, at least, has really wanted to get rid of gender entirely. So you can see this sort of churning going on very early on. Even Simone de Beauvoir was talking about this in her existential philosophy of this idea of getting rid of what she and others have called the social construct of gender and really moving to this direction of, you know, genderlessness, which you can see, you know, went right along with this idea of getting rid of a woman's fertility, getting rid of motherhood. So it's incredibly political. I mean, it's just that nobody wants to offend those who are either feminist or otherwise who think that if they're a man in a woman's clothing and think they're a woman, that they are a woman. So that's really what's pushing this, what's behind that whole motivation.
Relate the title of the book, The End of Woman, to people like Caitlyn Jenner, to Rachel Levine, to Leah Thomas, to Ricky Valerie Cole. These men, biological men, who are now lauded as the quintessence of what it means to be a woman.
Yeah. No, and that I think that's just the remarkable part is all these women who have fought for the rights of women and for the recognition of women. And, you know, suddenly they're lockstep with these men who think that they're women. So, yeah, you can really see that what's happening is that for, you know, all the efforts that women are making, suddenly we're sort of right back where we started from because Caitlyn Jenner, of course, was Woman of the Year. You've got Rachel Levine, who's the most decorated military. I can't remember what her title was or his title.
She's the first female four-star admiral.
Thank you. So these areas in which, you know, women are still striving and talking about sort of this glass ceiling are now being filled up with trans women. So that's, I think, the fundamental problem. And of course, you know, sports is going to become, unless states are really willing to make the effort to outlaw boys and girls sports, that's going to be the next area for sure that women are just going to continually be pushed out just merely by sheer biology. I mean, that's just how it works. So yeah, that's really the trend that we're seeing is women are just being pushed out by these men who are claiming to be women.
To what the end of women. Talk about the irreparable harm that feminism has done with these ABCs. I think about abortion, birth control, and then casual sex.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge question and, you know, very separate parts. I think, you know, you could see in someone like Margaret Sanger that, again, that question of how do we make women more like men? How do we allow women to have sexual relations and that sort of similar side effects of what men experience without resulting in a 9-month pregnancy and, of course, a child thereafter? So, you know, that was definitely part of the push of the 1900s. But you get in what happened fundamentally is that contraception then allowed couples who are heterosexual couples to start thinking of their sexual relationships just in terms of pleasure. And so it doesn't take too many decades before people are realizing, well, what, how is our sexual act any different than what same-sex couples are doing? It's just about pleasure as well. So when you tear out that piece of fertility, you know, it changes the dynamic entirely. And I think, you know, it took quite a while for that to happen, but slowly those things changed. But in addition to that, we know that, you know, abortion has been argued, you know, before the Dobbs decision, of course, that women had to have abortion because their birth control might not work. And so abortion became the backstop of a child who wasn't wanted, needed to be taken care of, because abortion truly is what feminists and what the national narrative, you know, tells women every day. That is the way that we level the playing field, by making women, allowing women to be like men because they don't have to bear a child. So these kinds of things have really, you know, dramatically changed our sense of ourselves and continually idolized the masculine. You know, you see this sort of in the girl boss language and, you know, all of those different elements. So they have played a really significant role in leading to, you know, the trans movement and leading to same-sex marriage. All of these kinds of things have changed the landscape of the culture significantly.
You make the interesting point in the book that not anyone could write this book. A man really couldn't write this book. Only a woman could write this book, and not just any woman. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, so I was really puzzled. Why doesn't this book exist? Because I found all of this content from this particularly first wave feminism that I had never heard in my life. And I had dug very deeply into second wave feminism. And so I was just amazed, like, why has no one written this book? And of course, you know, like you mentioned, a man couldn't have written the book because nobody would read it. I think the feminists would be so quick to say, you know, it's just a patriarchal screed. I also, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mom by and large. That's how I spend most of my time. And I don't have tenure anywhere. I don't have a career that, you know, if I'm canceled from, is going to change our life very much. So I think that was the other reason. I've had people in the past, women approach me and say, how can you get away with writing the books that you have written? And, you know, that's part of it, is I'm not worried about being canceled the way that someone who has been, you know, building a career for many decades is. So I think that's the real advantage of, you know, my position and why I was able to get this book through and out to people. We'll see how long it lasts until it, you know, inevitably it will be canceled by someone somewhere. But yeah, I think it's nice to be in this place where I have some relative safety compared to other women who might be interested in the topic.
An incredible statement made in the book that I'd like you to elaborate on as well. The idea that feminism, only next to Marxism, is the most powerful brand in the world. I mean, this is a brand that has ubiquitous power.
Yeah. One of the things that I really wanted to do with this book was make it accessible for people that didn't have any kind of philosophical background, because there is a lot of content on women, but a lot of it is in very academic language and really hard to read and not remotely a page turner. And I wanted this book to be a page turner. I wanted anybody to be able to sit down with it and, you know, read the whole thing. So I tried to figure out, you know, how do I talk about feminism in a way that anybody can understand? And of course, you know, we understand brands well. We understand, you know, Nike and Adidas and all of these different ways in which companies rebrand themselves and they present a message, and there's a whole ethos that goes with it. And so it just seemed like feminism was a really, it was much easier to describe it instead of just as an ideology or a philosophical tradition. It was a lot easier to talk about it as a brand, because you can see how it's gone through these different stages where it has rebranded itself. It's reinvented itself. And, you know, we see this even, as I mentioned, Barbie already, but Barbie's just another example of feminism rebranding itself to a new audience. So a lot of the feminists that are, you know, created so much public policy and public perception that we see today, a lot of them are getting older. Most of them are over 60. And so you can see, you know, a movie like Barbie, which uses a lot of kind of emotional and irrational argumentation. It uses pink, it uses nostalgia, it uses some tender moments, that this is a way that they're trying to rebrand feminism to appeal to a new generation. It's because if you come out, you know, and this is the cleverness, I think, that happened in the 1950s and 60s, Betty Friedan used this masterfully. You know, if the Marxists came out and said, we just want you to be Marxist, and just told people on a rational level, you know, go back and read Marx or something, it would never have taken root. And of course, in the Soviet Union, it was done by force through the military. People realized that was not going to happen in the United States, and it had to be done through other means, through advertising in particular. And, you know, the force of media and television, those things were all coming, you know, into their own when around the time of feminism's rise. So this is really how they've been so effective in branding it, by using the ways in which women think, you know, the ways in which women can be convinced very, very easily without using rational argumentation.
You do a wonderful job of breaking the book into three major sections before you get to the solution. the lost girls, the mean girls, and no girls. Talk a little bit about that first category, the lost girls, the girls that are broken and yet are the ones who set the table for feminism as we see it today.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. One of the patterns that really emerged from my research was, you know, I looked back at all these women, Mary Wollstonecraft and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and, you know, certainly Kate Millett and others that came later. But 201, these were all incredibly broken women. They all had, you know, major areas in their life that needed healing or that needed, you know, some kind of resolution to. And the hard part is that rather than looking back and saying, you know, I just had horrible parents, the solution was, well, we just need to change parents, you know, which isn't the case in Mary Wollstonecraft's case. And so it was just what happened was this idea of always moving further left, further towards socialism, towards communism, towards libertine ideas to try and fix things without really recognizing the wreckage that would happen. So there was no sense of, you know, maybe we should go back to something like the Ten Commandments. And in fact, that was actually why a lot of this started, because around the time of the French Revolution, the Enlightenment thinkers had taken over, and much of their effort was to get rid of anything that was dependent upon the Bible for their reason and for action. And they wanted to get rid of the Ten Commandments entirely and anything related to the Bible. And so the way that they did that was this dependency on what they called reason and reasoning to, you know, why the way that man should act. So that's the real basis for a lot of these ideas, is just if they can get rid of tradition and break these taboos, then they can kind of create this utopia. And of course, time and again, all we see is things just getting worse because they're not working within the confines of human nature. And that, you know, just created all of these continual problems to the point where it's very hard to even figure out how to go back, because things have gone so far and gotten to be such a mess that it's hard to even imagine plugging back into our cultural ethos, these, you know, notions like the Ten Commandments and whatnot. So anyway, that's really what the lost girls have brought us, is these are the women that are, you know, incredibly broken. They shouldn't be anywhere near public policy. And yet they're the ones who have really dictated the way that women think in the world today.
You just mentioned the French Revolution, and that was a real seminal point in history for establishing a secular order in place of a spiritual order.
Yeah, no, and this is huge. I don't think we can really overstate how significant the French Revolution was in our way of thinking, especially when it comes to feminism, because that's Mary Wollstonecraft, who's considered the godmother of feminism. She's thinking right along, you know, the same terms as someone like Thomas Paine, who is called the first socialist, really. This idea of how do we get rid of any kind of hierarchy? How do we get rid of monarchy? How do we get rid of any kind of hierarchy or patriarchy in the church? And families, how do we get rid of the military? They just wanted this very flattened society, which, you know, we end up seeing, of course, an effort to make that in communism under the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union, this desire to get rid of all of these structures of humanity that had been built up over centuries. They're trying to get rid of all of them. And that's really the template that feminism followed moving forward, was, you know, getting to people to think more like Marxists, without any of these structures, instead of thinking, you know, along in any kind of biblical terms.
Yeah, you mention in your book, this is so poignant and profound, Mary Wollstonecraft, she rejected motherhood, and yet she became the mother of someone who wrote the gothic novel Frankenstein.
Yeah.
The way you cash that out in the book is great reading, but it's powerful because it's a harbinger of that which will come later on, which eventually happened in our generation, the mutilation of people.
Yeah, no, that was one of those insights. You know, when you're writing a book, you don't really always know what you're going to find and how things are going to fit together. And so it was pretty remarkable to look at someone like Mary Shelley, who, you know, Mary Shelley was married to Percy Shelley, who was a huge romantic, huge force for breaking down any kind of taboo. He also is, curiously, you know, was the one that came up with what I call the three pillars of feminism. It was in his work that that's what feminism became moving forward. And these ideas were free love, the occult, and smashing the patriarchy. He put all those things together in his work in what he called the women's revolution. So Mary Shelley then, and they're, both of them are fascinated by this idea of creating and creation and science and electricity, you know, all these kinds of new concepts. And so it's really interesting to see that she creates in the book Frankenstein this creature who ultimately is just this miserable, you know, just unloved creature. And, you know, in many respects, you know, people speculate that she was sort of putting herself in that because she probably felt a certain amount of guilt that her mother died after she was born. And, you know, she ran away from her father to be with Shelley before Shelley was divorced from his first wife. And anyway, there was just a mess in her life. So there's this desire to sort of create something out of nothing using technology. And of course, they didn't have the technology to do what we're doing today. And that's the amazing thing, is to see the lengths that people are going to sort of make themselves whole in the way that Mary Shelley probably longed for. It certainly is in the book of Frankenstein and the creature. And, you know, now we're seeing this with, you know, if we just change some body parts out, then somehow that's supposed to bring healing to what it is that people are really suffering, which of course will never bring healing to it. And this is why we see, you know, the fruits of it, that suicide levels are much higher after any kind of trans surgeries. And, you know, we also see it in feminism itself, just how miserable women are. And these are the statistics that most feminists will never talk about, just the rise in depressions, suicide attempts or successful attempts at suicide, substance abuse, divorces, all of these kinds of things are really pointing to incredibly unhappy people because, again, we're not working with human nature. We're working directly against it to create something of our own imagining.
You just mentioned the word romantic. What was the role that romanticism played in the advancement of feminism?
Oh, I think it was a huge, huge role. I mean, romanticism, of course, is reacting to the very sort of strict logic of many Enlightenment thinkers like Immanuel Kant. And the romantics wanted mystery. They wanted emotion. They wanted things that were sort of went against what they saw as very sterile logic. And Percy Shelley was absolutely, you know, a romantic poet who was trying to push taboos and sort of get out of anything that they considered, you know, archaic or just old. So yeah, I think that it was a huge influence, and we probably never would have gotten the feminism that we inherited without the romantic movement, because it also worked very much on the principles of emotion instead of on reason and logic or any kind of tradition. So yeah, I think it can't be overstated how much romanticism played into the movement itself.
And you look today at the relationship between the occult and the destruction of the patriarchy that you're talking about earlier, and that was part of what came out of the romantic movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The occult was very much a vibrant element and certainly a piece of romanticism. Percy Shelley himself was hugely interested in it. And, I pulled a lot of these ideas from this actually Swedish thinker's work called Satanic Feminism. And it was published by Oxford University Press. An amazing work in the sense of just showing the role that the occult played, you know, during this time period. And it wasn't just one or two people. I mean, it was just widely spread and a very active part of feminism, especially if you move forward, you know, someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, she got a lot of her ideas from seances and using mediums and was, you know, very involved in that second great awakening in the United States. But that part of it that, especially in New York State, that was using a lot of, you know, rapping tables and whatnot to call on the demonic. So yeah, it's pretty amazing when I started digging into it just to see, you know, wow, the occult is really a major piece in this. And it comes up again, of course, too, in the 60s and 70s. There's a book called The Sisterhood is Powerful that was hugely popular. It was a compilation of work by a woman named Robin Morgan, who I think is still alive. And in it actually has spells in the back of it, sort of for everyday use. So this was a major piece of it because, of course, the occult, and, you know, typically has always been a way to undermine men by women. You know, this is why there's always a female witch that gets a lot more airtime than I think wizards do, because women just saw this as a way to be powerful through witchcraft and through spells and the occult. And so this is why it returns over and over again throughout the movement.
And in recent generations, the personification of that is Madonna.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Absolutely. And so she's one. I mean, she even just recently, she did a photo shoot in Italy in the Italian Vogue that is featuring her as Christ at the Last Supper. And it's, I mean, the pictures are just horrifying to look at because, of course, there's 12 women who are supposed to be the apostles, and it's just awful. So yeah, she's certainly emblematic of that. But you can see it also in the ways in which most of the pop stars, I think Halsey just did one, maybe in the last 2 or 3 years, representing herself as the Virgin Mary. There's this sort of this goddess worship going on with women like Beyonce and whatnot. So it's become very popular in the pop world to have these women make themselves goddesses, actually. So it's, yeah, it's really tucked in so many remarkable places that you don't expect. And once you start seeing it, it's everywhere. I just wrote a piece a few months ago about, you know, why I can't shop at Barnes and Noble anymore, because it feels like every part of the store is touched in some way with the occult, whether it's products or books or, you know, especially in the children's section, you know, the areas where you don't want your children, you know, dabbling in any kind of occult activity. It's all, it seems like it's just everywhere. So yeah, I think it's been very subtle, but now it's kind of out in the open in terms of our culture. TV shows, movies, all of that is really not afraid of it as a topic anymore.
I think of Elizabeth Stanton or Susan B. Anthony, and you think these are wholesome feminist women. You paint the other side of the story.
Yeah, no, I thought that too. And when I started looking at this, I thought, okay, this is, I'll spend a couple of days researching this. I'm sure I'll find some great quotes I can at least pull to show, you know, that first wave feminism was actually good. And I was just amazed. Yeah, I think that Elizabeth Stanton was really crafty. I think she, you know, talking about branding, she did an amazing job of making herself really the center of the suffrage movement. So much so that even the Seneca Falls Convention that people talk about as sort of the start of the suffrage movement, the women's movement, she painted Susan B. Anthony into that story, even though they didn't even know each other at that point. But Susan B. Anthony, they met later, and Susan B. Anthony was single. So she ended up becoming really a voice, you know, the mouthpiece of Katie Stanton, because Elizabeth was home with her children and couldn't travel the way that Susan B. Anthony could. But basically what ended up happening was that Elizabeth Katie Stanton did so many things that she shut down the suffrage movement for about 30 years. She was even thrown off the board of her own organization, partially because she wrote this book called The Women's Bible, which is a commentary on Old and New Testament. And it uses all these ideas of atheism, of theosophy, which was this sort of cobbled together new age religion by this Russian noblewoman, Madame Blavatsky. And Katie Stanton never really called herself an adherent, but she had many of her friends who were involved in the book were adherents to theosophy. So you can see elements of that in her women's Bible. But the other thing was they got very much involved in this scandal with this woman named Victoria Woodhull, who, by the way, Gloria Steinem had a picture of Victoria Woodhull in her office, you know, how many years later, 60, 70 years later, maybe more. But Victoria Woodhull was named by the press Mrs. Satan because she had been a medium her whole life, and she was very much into free love. And she was just this really this indomitable spirit on the scene in New York City. And so Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were upset they weren't getting enough press. And so they had her come be a speaker. And, you know, this just created all kinds of chaos, because then it was finally figured out that there was this big scandal at the heart of it. And anyway, this infighting and this scandal, which I, of course, I go into in the book, but it's way too detailed to talk about here, that really, you know, got Katie's, their reputation was destroyed. And they were, you know, no longer in any way really involved in the suffrage movement. And that's why suffrage didn't happen for another, you know, 30 years after the demise of their effort. But nobody really knows that. I mean, I think most of us think of suffrage and we think of those two, and we don't think of anybody at 1919 and who was involved then. I mean, we just have the sense that these two women were really the cornerstone of it. And we have this impression that they were just these great noble women fighting for something really good, but without really knowing any of the much more colorful trimmings of their lives.
Yeah, Elizabeth Stanton in particular. I mean, you can talk about Susan B. Anthony and being minted and all that, but Elizabeth Stanton, I find so interesting. She grew up as a strict Calvinist, and then she becomes the priestess of feminism in the sense of inventing a new Trinity. So instead of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you have feminism, spiritualism, and hypersexuality.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, we don't know that much about Susan B. Anthony at this point. One of her biographers spent 4 days burning her letters, her papers, any of her correspondence, anything that she had left, which, you know, of course, begs the question, why would a biographer do that? Most biographers, you know, hang on to that stuff and make sure that these things are saved for the future. So there's a lot of gaps in our understanding of Susan B. Anthony's life. Although, you know, at certain points, I know she was engaged in the spiritualism. She actually made some statement about how she just wishes that when she spoke publicly, the spirit would just take her over so that she didn't have to do the actual work of it. So anyway, yeah, it's really remarkable to start looking behind the curtain a little bit and see this was not some sort of purist movement, but it just had, you know, so much baggage associated with it.
Yeah, talk about Stanton's Declaration of Sentiments. That's based on the Declaration of Independence, and it produces what is arguably the greatest revolution the world has ever known.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that happened at her spirit table. She had this idea for, she was doing this convention, and she didn't know how to make it something bigger than it was. She wanted to make it, like you said, it's a huge revolution. So, you know, presumably it's with the help of the spirits, she decides to sort of mimic the Declaration of Independence, and she calls it this Declaration of Sentiments. But curiously, she doesn't really even know what women should be complaining about. You know, the big thing is, of course, the suffrage piece, and that was something that she was very focused on. She had a lot of resentment that actually colored men would have the capacity to vote before she did, and that her racism actually is what splintered the suffrage movement into two different groups. But, you know, there's this great story about how she's spending all this time trying to figure out what the grievances are, you know, that women should have towards men. And she finally has to ask, I think it's her husband and the husband of a good friend, well, what would middle-class women be upset about, or poor women be upset about? How do we articulate this? Because she was so wealthy and sort of, you know, protected from all of these realities. She didn't even know how to articulate it herself. And of course, the friend's husband jokes about how, you know, these grievances must be really great. If you can't come up with them, you need us to come up with them instead of yourself. So, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on that Stanton obviously, you know, pressed into to make her movement feel like it was, you know, much more significant than it really was.
You sort of hinted at this, but elaborate on the connection between abolitionism and feminism.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting, another one of those cycles that we see, because of course, abolitionism was happening. You had a lot of people that were abolitionist, and then they sort of hitched their wagon of feminism onto abolitionism, you know, kind of making the comparison that skin color is the same as sex and whatnot. And, you know, this should sound very familiar to all of us, because this is the exact same thing that happened in the 1950s and 60s with the civil rights movement. Because again, you see this rise in feminism, but not only that, in that era, you also see the rise of the gay and lesbian movement. And actually the gays specifically changed the language of their own movement to make themselves victims, you know, victim minorities, the way that women already had. And this is how they were so successful in sort of changing public opinion, was by changing the narrative about their own behavior. And that was just a really key piece. One of the interesting things that I did not put in the book, though, was that in the 1940s and 50s, there was a woman named Susan B. Anthony II, who was actually the niece of the first Susan B. Anthony. She was very involved in this communist group called the Congress for American Women. And, you know, people were just amazed that she was able to articulate so clearly, you know, what the women's grievances were and connecting it with abolition and with the African-American efforts for equal rights. And it was interesting to see this because, of course, all she had to do was go back and read what her aunt had written. You know, it was the same, almost the same kind of rhetoric that was being used. And of course, this time she's, Susan B. Anthony II is really couching it within the Marxist framework instead of, you know, what they were using previously, which was not Marxist, but had much more egalitarian type of language, a little bit less stark than the communist language. But it's interesting to see just these patterns of, you know, all these things that you see in the 1800s, they come back, you know, almost on steroids at a later stage and are just much more powerful in the 60s and 70s because of everything that's happening socially and the Cold War and, you know, all kinds of things going on.
I was watching something recently. I can't place it in my mind right now, but a popular show, and the feminine mystique by Betty Friedan was brought up. And I thought, wow, this is a book that even if people haven't read, they know the title of.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can ever overestimate the impact that book had. In 1963, it comes out, 3 million copies are sold within years. And, you know, it's an amazing piece of work because you just see Betty Friedan was just masterful at really speaking to the woman's heart and trying to use that against us to, you know, lead us to her own ideology that she was focused on. And, you know, there's a great book by Daniel Horowitz that exposes the communist roots of Betty Friedan. Ironically, he's not trying to expose it for negative reasons. He actually thinks, you know, this is kind of amazing. Here was this communist woman that was able to hide her communism in the time of McCarthy and still be very successful in getting communist ideas and new left ideas populated in the culture. So he sees that as this, you know, just great act of defiance. And of course, I gobbled up much of that and found, you know, other sources corroborating it. But she was very much a communist. She had been, you know, since she was even late in high school, but certainly in college, very connected to this organization I already referred to, the Congress for American Women, which was, you know, disbanded by the House Committee for Un-American Activities back in 1949, I think, because it was such a piece of propaganda for the Soviets to really get in the minds of women. So she very much was at heart trying to get women to think like Marxists. So that the idea being a woman, if she is productive outside the home, that was the goal, to get all women outside the home, that the home was a form of slavery. And she refers to it as a comfortable concentration camp. And curiously, she was also hated Hitler. And yet this is the same piece that Hitler used, you know, at Auschwitz. You've got that sign that says at the gates, you know, Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free. And this is exactly the same ideology that she thinks she's using, that's different because it's from Stalin and the communists, but it's the same socialist concept of people being productive workers. And that's really what she was trying to get. But again, it's masterful because she uses that sense of victimhood so beautifully, of women, you know, this is a horrible place, you have to get out of it, you're really oppressed, this is terrible. And she also uses that sense of that fear of missing out that I think women are really taken by in so many respects. I mean, even Eve is taken by this, that, you know, what am I missing? What is God withholding when the serpent is tempting her? So these timeless ways in which women can be manipulated. And she just went full bore and the culture just absorbed it like crazy. And this is really how you can see this untethering of the woman from her children, from her home, from her husband. And this is at the heart of what has happened with abortion, that you can get a woman so far that she doesn't remember or doesn't know the beauty of that relationship. And instead, she can see it as actually an obstacle, because of course, it's an obstacle to that, what Friedan makes as a, you know, freedom from slavery, the workplace.
Friedan was also the founder of NOW, National mm-hmm. Organization for Women. And that's unabashedly Marxist. And yeah. It's part of the inroad we now have for this ubiquitous idea of the oppressed and the oppressor. The oppressor being the patriarch, the oppressed being the family, the women and children. Yeah. That's now in the jet stream in our civilization.
Yes. And it comes from Friedan, but again, it also comes from Kate Millett, whom I mentioned earlier, also Angela Davis. And I think, you know, they were able to really get it in through the women's studies programs and the academies. And I think that if you did not have feminism and the success that they've had with feminism, not just in the academic world or through these books, but, you know, we have to be mindful that it's everywhere now. It's in Hollywood, it's in politics, it's in fashion magazines. You know, all of these places have the same, exact same messaging. That was all intentional. They very much wanted to get it into the culture in such a way that sort of creates this lock on the way that people think. But if those things had not been so successful with feminism, we never would have ended up with the woke ideology that we're dealing with now, where, you know, it's now just not men and women. It's now depends on what color you are, what your sexual orientation is. All of these things have taken on that exact same pattern of oppressed and oppressor. And that's really what the woke culture is trying to, you know, use to manipulate society. So yeah, it's absolutely all about power and control. And, you know, we just continue to buy into it. And this is why they have power and control and the kind of influence that they have because of the success of feminism.
Yeah. You mentioned Kate Millett, and she was actually known as the female Marx.
She was. Yeah. No, she was a force. I've gotten to know her sister. Kate died several years ago, and her sister Mallory is a devoted Christian. And she and I have spent a lot of time talking about Kate and hearing stories about her. And she's been sharing many of Kate's books with me, with a lot of the personal commentary that goes with it. And she was a deeply disturbed woman. Kate was, you know, in and out of mental hospitals and really just, I think, did far more damage to the culture than we can ever even fathom because of what she did, both with feminism, but she also was very active in the notion of people with mental illness not being locked up, not being helped in institutions. And so this is one of the part of the reasons why there's so many homeless people with mental illness who are not being cared for. And because of this trend that Kate really kicked off with several of her books, she was also involved in Iran in the revolution there. So anyway, it's amazing to dig into this woman's life and just see, you know, again, this woman who was so tragic, so mentally ill, and how her work is just everywhere now. Just that this amazing how much of an influence she had for someone so relatively unknown in the world.
Yeah. So what is the connection between lesbianism and feminism? This relates to a section that you wrote with respect to Kate Millett.
Yeah. So this is, I think it's a great question because, you know, during the 60s and 70s, there was sort of this, you know, every lesbian was a feminist, not every feminist was a lesbian kind of understanding. But lesbianism really became this kind of pinnacle for all women, that this was their belief was that the lesbian lifestyle was the best lifestyle for women because you never had to answer to a man and you didn't have to worry about your fertility. So that was something that was very actively pushed. And, you know, Kate was a prime example of this. She was married and then divorced and in and out of a string of every kind of relationship you can imagine. And she ended up, when she died, she was married to another woman. She had a heart attack in Paris. But yeah, so lesbianism was really pushed as just this very important social thing. And, you know, even had the calling of killing all men. I mean, this was, they were not shy about their beliefs about how awful men were and that men really just needed to be destroyed. And it's amazing to see, though, so many feminists that I've encountered, their life changes, especially when they have a son. You know, they suddenly have a transformation in their life because they don't know what to do with this little boy that they love so much, whom they've been trained to think of as the enemy. So yeah, there's all kinds of fissures and, you know, even just that basic question of how does a civilization reproduce itself without men, you know, seems to be not something that they're thinking much about because they're so focused on the ideology and trying to get men out of the picture in so many different ways.
I want to read something from your book. It was chilling. And you actually reproduce these unbelievable words that Kate Millett and her comrades chanted in Greenwich Village in the late 1960s. So here's what you wrote. Why are we here today? This is Millett and her comrades. We are here to make revolution. What kind of revolution? The cultural revolution. Shades of what happened in China. And how do we make the cultural revolution? By destroying the American family. How do we destroy the family? By destroying the American patriarch. And how do we destroy the American patriarch? By taking away his power. How do we do that? This is being chanted. By destroying monogamy. And how do we destroy monogamy? By promoting promiscuity, eroticism, prostitution, abortion, and homosexuality. All of this has been achieved. It was a dream back then, but all of that has been achieved to an extent that they couldn't have imagined when they were chanting it in Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's chilling when you really start putting this ungodly litany that they put together, putting that together and seeing what the context was in which they were saying that, you know, what the culture looked like and then what it looks like today. And yeah, it's just overwhelming. And I think it, in many respects, it provides us with a way back, actually, you know, that especially for men, you know, men, you don't need to engage in dialogue with this. What you need to do is promote monogamy. What you need to do is promote your family. What you need to do is, you know, be the best father and husband that you can be, because that's how we stave off these issues. But yeah, I think it's absolutely chilling how effective it has been and, you know, how they really have destroyed the family through these very awful things.
Maybe a few words about Herbert Marcuse. You know, he laid the groundwork for a lot of this, the groundwork for the New Left. He was at the forefront of critical race theory,
yeah,
which is just the racist part of critical theory.
Right.
Tell us a little more about him.
So Herbert Marcuse and Wilhelm Reich actually sort of worked together. They were both at the Frankfurt School that was at Columbia University here in the United States. They were both German and came over here. And, you know, even how that Frankfurt School was set up at Columbia University, I think, has left all kinds of people scratching their heads because it was very much a communist, you know, leftist organization. But they saw, you know, there were some real issues with the communist agenda and making it all about class. And so they realized, you know, we've got to stop talking about the worker and the proletariat and all of these, you know, classical Marxist concepts. How do we shift that into the culture? How do we change the culture entirely? Wilhelm Reich wrote and published his book in 1936 called The Sexual Revolution, which was really a blueprint for what became the sexual revolution in the United States. I think so many people, we have this impression that the sexual revolution was just sort of the spontaneous thing that happened. You know, it was just the fruit of the 60s and the Vietnam War and, you know, all of these things. Well, no, it was absolutely planned in order to happen at a later date. And the 60s just, it took off. So it's sort of this chicken or the egg kind of thing. Like, I think a lot of people are beginning to realize that this was actually not just a spontaneous thing at all, but was really very much planned by Reich. And Marcuse was remarkable because of the fact that he just saw the cultural piece as being so important. And again, you've got Kate Millett and Angela Davis who studied under both of them. And this idea that they had to get these pieces, not just, you know, and the political fringe, but into the minds of everyday people, much that, you know, the same way that Betty Friedan did of how do we get this into the minds of women. So that's really, you know, the full import of what they have done. I think we're finally just figuring out. And again, you're right. If we didn't have critical theory, we wouldn't have had critical race theory. And it was all these concepts that have been used against us to really destroy the culture. And, you know, the big question being, well, what's the end result? Well, it's all about power for them. It's not, you know, a flourishing society with happy people in it. It really is about just being in control. There's no sort of, you know, they have a utopia in mind, but they're not even sure how to articulate what that is. So it's incredibly sad to see how we have just bought onto this because of the fact that it was just infiltrated everything and we didn't know how to push back. We didn't know what was happening. And, you know, I think we've gotten to the point now where we know what's happening and it's great, you know, to finally see some pushback, but we just need to keep doing more and more of it and people realizing the ways in which they're being brainwashed by all of this.
Yeah, brainwashed, I mean, that's a good word. You know, if you advance all of the information on one side of a ledger and you repress all the information on the other side of the ledger, you don't have education, you really do have brainwashing. And I did a podcast with Yonmi Park, and she was talking about this brainwashing that goes on at Columbia University, which is older than the country itself, and how Columbia University, an Ivy League school, is not teaching people how to think, but simply forcing people to regurgitate narratives. I mean, how important is it for people to learn to think again?
Yeah. No, and it's huge. I mean, it's really remarkable just how we are in this post-rational age. You know, even something like reading books. I mean, these are real challenges. I know it was for me at a certain point when I'd actually finished college and I went into graduate school and I thought, you know, I don't even know how to read a book well. I'm too distracted. I don't know how to focus properly. And I just forced myself to do it. But I think that most of us have so much going on, you know, just even in our daily lives and so many different kinds of distractions that sitting down with a book and being able to actually absorb the argument and really think through it is a challenge for most of us. So yeah, there's so much work that needs to be done. But the first one just needs to be showing people how, you know, expansive these concepts are and how much they have taken over, not just Columbia, but almost all of academia has absorbed this kind of narrative telling attitude about the world for sure.
We're just talking about the influence of Marcuse, and that influence is now being felt in drag queen story hours, the aggressive sexual education of small children, and the horrors of wokeism in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's an important piece of it too, is just this recognition of how important getting rid of sexual innocence, getting rid of monogamy, all of these things really are so vital to the left's effort, because you create broken people then who don't know, you know, it's very hard to form a family. It's very hard to resist tyranny, you know, all of these kinds of things. It just feeds into it. The more broken we become, the more control that they have.
I want your perspective on the pill. It's been an ecological disaster on many different levels, but it's been a disaster far beyond ecology.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. I think that's one of the hard things is it's very hard to talk about it because it feels like people have embraced it so much that they don't know the ecological damage that, you know, what it's doing to the fish and rivers and things like that, because it's kind of become taboo. But yeah, I think it's created so many of the problems that we have, again, because it's trying to erase the fertility of a woman and make her like a man. And so it just, you know, completely eradicates even something as basic as communication between a man and a woman, a husband and wife, you know, and that kind of trust that happens. And that's one of the beauties of a woman's fertility, is it was something she had to protect. And she had to protect herself because of that, because of the vulnerability that's associated with it. And so when you add something like the pill, that, you know, the whole dynamic changes, and suddenly, you know, the hookup culture is a realization, is something that can come about, because a woman doesn't really have to be so concerned the way that she would have been before. Not realizing, of course, that, you know, not only is her fertility at stake, it's also her emotions, her life, the decisions that she's making, you know, all of these relationships happening that we know statistically and just from psychology damage women much more on an emotional level than they do men. So that's, I think, the real tragedy, is just women feeling like, you know, the hookup culture is really the only way forward in terms of forming relationships, because otherwise you can't even start a relationship with someone unless that's how it starts, because of just the expectations that have come about in the culture that, you know, sexuality has become just kind of a contact sport instead of something much deeper that's meant to bond a couple, both, you know, through hormones and biologically, but also through children.
We mentioned abortion earlier. I want you to elaborate on the transition we've gone through in our culture from saying abortion should be legal, they should be rare, they should be safe, to now we're actually having abortion showers.
Yeah. Oh, it's so sickening. Yeah. I mean, for years, that was really the mantra. I mean, you probably remember Bill Clinton talking about that, legal, safe, and rare was something that came out of his mouth certainly more than once. But no, there's been this real cultural shift where I think, you know, enough celebrities have had abortions and have, you know, talked about them at award ceremonies, and how if they hadn't had that abortion, their life would have been ruined and they wouldn't have gotten this Grammy or whatever. They've tried to culturally make it an attractive and good thing, really just changing the values of it instead of really seeing it as a tragedy. And yeah, it's incredible the campaigns that are available now, the Shout Your Abortion campaign, which was like $1 million to sort of promote this. You know, there's, in my book, I mentioned this one woman who talks about, you know, if she ever had an abortion, she would have a party after it that had like baby shaped cakes. And I mean, just horrifying things, like, you know, you can't believe that somebody has gotten to this point of thinking that an abortion is actually a good thing. So yeah, that's another one of those great places where you can just see how deep the brainwashing has become, if you can actually turn abortion into something that needs to be celebrated.
I suppose that's related to the second part of your book, where you talk about the mean girls, the emergence of this breed of women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the mean girls is, you know, the section of my book after the lost girls, what happens is you've got the mean girls, and these are the ones that are in power. A lot of them we know by just one name, you know, their family name has been dropped. We just know immediately who they are by saying their first name. And they have really controlled, you know, through their different empires. Look at someone like Oprah, or look at certainly Gloria Steinem is one of them, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, all across the spectrum, whether they're celebrities or political people. They're very much about controlling the narrative. And they're mean because, of course, they want to make sure that nobody else threatens their little empire. And, you know, we see this meanness. All you have to do is watch The View, you know, where you always, every episode, I'd be amazed if they ever an episode where the women on the left always outnumber the women on the right. The conservatives are usually one or two, and their voices are shouted down by the much more outspoken women on the left often. So it's just amazing how, you know, these women have used power and manipulation and, you know, all of these different efforts to maintain their own narrative. And so, yeah, the mean girls are alive and well, for sure.
Second wave feminism, they were masters at exploiting the use of the media, particularly television. And Phil Donahue was a facilitator of all of this, and Hugh Hefner. Elaborate.
Yeah. So this was one of the interesting things to look into, was just the role that both advertising played, but also, you know, television was new. And you had someone like Gloria Steinem, who's incredibly attractive, and people just wanted to have her on their show. She was articulate. She had this new magazine called Ms. And so it's amazing to see how they used magazines and women's magazines, which have obviously predated any of the second wave feminism, but all of those sort of turned into avenues for reaching women with their narrative. And yeah, I think it's really incredible. In fact, there's all these crazy stories about Betty Friedan actually just being a complete tyrant. There was one show that she told the producer that if they didn't give her way about something, she was going to say this bad word 11 times live on air if they didn't give her what she wanted. I just did Dennis Prager's show, and he said that when he was 28 years old, he did a debate with her. At one point, she got so upset with him, she called him a male chauvinist piglet, and she walked out. Yeah. He said, I don't know why I got called a piglet, probably because he was 28, but she walked off the stage. And, you know, I was like, what did you do next? You know, I just assumed the debate was over. He said, I just kept talking. And she eventually came back and finished the debate. But, you know, it was kind of the first time that I had heard someone actually like not let her tantrum win. You know, he figured out the way, just keep talking and moving forward and ignore the tantrum. And she came back and, you know, they finished the debate. And, you know, what I would give to see that debate now. But yeah, it was those kinds of things, you know, again, these mean girl tactics to get their way. And, you know, all the while, of course, you know, using makeup and savvy clothing and, you know, all these different ways of things that women are drawn into to make it look appealing. And, you know, part of it too was just, you know, Betty Friedan was kind of a holdout on the, you know, allowing lesbians and gays into the movement. Trans obviously wasn't an issue then the way it is now, but she very much was focused on heterosexual women. And, you know, some of that probably had to do with her Marxist training and just trying to be normal and look like you fit in. I mean, that was really the effort of the communists of her era. But she eventually, you know, caved on that. I think it was just the pressure of it got too big. She was at a national convention. I think it was the one in Houston for women, and eventually came out in support of it because of all these antics that were used by the women to sort of undermine anybody that was just focused on heterosexuals. So that was another piece of it that was used a lot. I think it was letting out rats at a wedding dress shop, and, you know, the bra burning you hear about in Atlantic City, you know, these different ways in which they were masterful to use the media with strong visuals to make their cases as well.
You use the word masterful a few times here. The queen bees, as you call them, were masters at rhetoric, masters at using language to obscure the devastating realities of feminism.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It just all was really smoke and mirrors. And you know, you don't see the real devastation until, you know, you're with a woman who's 60, 70 years old. I had one woman I met in California recently, and she said, this was my life. This is how I lived my life. And, you know, just the deep regret that she had now that she has no husband, no children, her parents are dead, you know, just this kind of deep isolation. And, you know, we know where that isolation comes from. It's really the effort. When we're isolated, we are weak. And, you know, that's really the whole idea of it.
Is feminism, if you were to sum it up, is it the preaching of discontent to women? I mean, is that the essence of it?
I think so. I think that that's a really good articulation, because from that comes the resentment towards men, also the sense of entitlement that women have, where we think we can do whatever we want, that we're entitled to have it all. You know, that was a really big focus of the feminist movement in the earlier years of the, you know, 1970, was this myth that we could have it all. Well, we can have it all, but probably not all at once. And, you know, do you really want it all? You know, there's a lot of pieces in life to juggle. And that's the beauty, I think, of a woman's life, is just all of these different seasons. It's always changing, especially when you have children and they're growing. And yeah, I think that that kind of discontent has really undermined us in many ways, because it does make us always wanting more. And yeah, it's been highly effective.
Feminism's main achievement may well have been to obscure the meaning of womanhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a woman is a mother. She's meant to protect, to nurture, to shelter others, either biologically, spiritually, or psychologically. And if a woman is told that her life is all about her, then she cannot mother others in all of these capacities that she's made to mother others. So yeah, the child becomes the enemy, and we're fundamentally changed into narcissists. So yeah, I think that's right.
The third section of your book, where you talk about no girls, chapter 9, Margaret and Els.
Yeah, Margaret and the Els.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you made the point that part of the genius of the women's movement was equating women's rights with those of blacks and gays. So the conflation of the categories became a major victory.
Yeah, because now you hear all kinds of language about sex blindness and whatnot, not recognizing that there are incredible distinctions and differences between men and women, and, you know, trying to erase those entirely through birth control, through abortion, you know, through this idealization of the masculine that I think has contributed significantly to the issues.
John Money, no discussion on this topic would be complete without discussing what he did in inventing the term gender identity.
Yeah. So John Money was this scientist that thought that you could actually be born with the wrong gender. You could be born, you know, like we hear all the time today, I was a man trapped in a woman's body, or, you know, vice versa or whatever. So he's doing all of his work. He ends up with these twin boys, one of whom had, there was an accident in his circumcision. And I think part of his penis was removed entirely. So he just thought, well, why don't we just test out my theory and make him a girl? And so that's what his parents did. They went along with it. And in the meantime, he's also sexually molesting these boys as they're being raised, because, of course, he has access to them through his practice. And anyway, tragically, the boy that was called the girl ended up being told the truth and went back to being a man. Both men, when they were older, committed suicide because the abuse that they had undergone was just so significant. It was obviously crushing to them. But the craziest part is that his ideas stuck. I mean, people are still using them. This is where all of the transgender, all of the trans, you know, change in gender, all of it comes from Money's work, which has been largely discredited. But people have just hung on to it and, you know, taken it on as if this is, you know, the gospel. So, yeah, Money's influence is really amazing and tragic and just unbelievable that this kind of an awful, you know, therapist that had no right doing any kind of psychoanalysis on anyone was so influential on not just those boys' lives, but all of us.
Yeah. And I think Margaret Sanger fits into the same category. I mean, the enormous disservice that she has done to Western civilization, to human civilization, through birth control, through eugenic control, through population control. She was a purveyor of the population bomb myth and many other myths as well, but she was a master at that, and she wreaked havoc. I mean, you can even look at the science of being well-born mm-hmm. and its influence on Nazi Germany and the concentration camps and the eradication of Jews.
Yeah. No, it's incredible, the eugenics movement that came out of her work. And there was no hiding. I mean, it wasn't like she was hiding this aspect of it. I mean, even Planned Parenthood comes directly from her work. So it's amazing. She's another one, exactly, that has just destroyed so much, created this wasteland. And people have this sense that her work was, you know, such a wonderful boon to civilization.
Yeah, I call her the birth mother of Planned Parenthood. You make the remarkable counterintuitive statement that birth control is the key to understanding how homosexuality went from being unacceptable to being actively embraced by American culture. Again, I find that counterintuitive, but there's a good way of contextualizing that.
Yeah, you know, back in the 80s, there was this law professor whom I've heard about. I know his family. He was a professor at Notre Dame Law, and he used to say, you know, birth control is going to lead to gay marriage. And his students thought he was nuts. Like, you're crazy. That doesn't make any kind of sense. But he was right. And the reason he was right and why he could see this back in this, you know, 70s and 80s when nobody else could see it is, again, you know, what I mentioned earlier, this idea that if heterosexual sex no longer is connected with fertility, then how is it any different from homosexual sex? It all becomes reduced to pleasure, potentially to bonding, but it's certainly not connected with children and actual family building. So if you've got enough couples who are contracepting and are taking on that attitude that their relationship is merely for sexual pleasure, it doesn't take too many steps to start seeing that heterosexual sex and homosexual sex are really the same thing. They're just about self-gratification. And that's really what has happened across the board. You know, you just hear people so lackadaisical about it, not really seeing that there are much more significant realities at play and at work than just that, you know, that sex is about gratification. But the fertility piece is really vital for understanding the family and for building up a civilization.
Yeah, you're just a master writer. You talk about the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization. Some elaboration on words or phrases like birthing person, bleeding person, chest feeder, egg-making person. The insanity of that, but it somehow or other has become acceptable, even in the definitions that you find in major dictionaries.
Yeah, and those are always changing. I mean, that was kind of the hard part about the book, was trying to keep up with the different changes that were happening in dictionaries. And they're always trying to navigate the trans issue and not offend anyone. And so, again, how do you come up with what a woman is? And, you know, one of my favorites is something like, a woman is a non-male, you know, which, of course, could be anything, you know. But yeah, it's really remarkable to see just how deeply this has gone and how offensive it is. It's just stripping us of real content of what it means to be human and making us very much into, you know, just sexual actors that are just seeking pleasure and gratification instead of something obviously much deeper that we all yearn for. And, you know, even if we don't know that we do, it's there, that deep desire to be loved and to love others. All of that gets lost in this because it has been reduced to gratification. Even that the latest word was thrown out was bonus hole. You know, it's just incredibly, you know, it's just awful kind of reality of speaking about our bodies and what they're meant for.
Unbelievable. This comes right from your book. Cambridge Dictionary released a new definition of womanhood in 2022, including those who identify as trans women. And it reads as follows: an adult who lives and identifies as female, though they may have been said to have a different sex at birth. That's from Cambridge. Merriam-Webster: having a gender identity that is opposite of male.
Yeah, that was the one. And all rooted in gender identity. So it's nothing biological anymore. It's all a matter of just feelings and emotions and sentiments. And it's always interesting, too, to see sort of how much is embraced about when people change to something that they're not. But what about, you know, you see this in the psychology of homosexuality as well. What about when people want to go back to what they originally were, you know, the detransitioners, but also people that want to go back to being heterosexual? You know, that isn't completely looked down upon as well. So, you know, these are all the slip showing of really realizing this is an absolute ideology that they are pushing because it's only one direction and that's accepted, you know, on a national scale. And that's to the deformation of what they are.
Talk about the effect of taking testosterone injections if you're a woman transitioning into a man. The description is horrifying.
Yeah. No, it's pretty incredible what happens. I mean, first things are things like weight loss and then the vocal cords being tightened and, you know, the voice getting deeper, getting hairier. But I, you know, the one that's just really awful is the uterus dries up eventually because it doesn't have estrogen and progesterone that obviously is needed in a woman's body to maintain a healthy uterus. So a lot of women using testosterone have to have their uterus removed because it just dries out. So yeah, there's a lot of incredible long-term effects that happen. I know there was one woman I was reading about that she was on testosterone and she had no idea. She had a beautiful voice. Well, her voice changed dramatically and, you know, she can't sing anymore. So it's those kinds of things that are major changes that, you know, most of which are, you know, you're not going back the other direction, especially once you've been on testosterone for longer periods of time.
Even male balding pattern.
Yes, exactly. All of that. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You really want to be a man?
I think that's a great question, though. I mean, that's the thing is we haven't said anything good about being a woman for 50 years. So, you know, of course they want to be a man. Of course they don't want to deal with a period and all of those things connected with our fertility, you know, breasts, you know, all of that is very awkward and uncomfortable and in many respects hard to adjust to. And this is what these girls want is they don't really want to be boys. They don't really want to be men. They just want to be a non-woman. And, you know, I think that that's the attraction is that aspect, not really to be a man.
Carrie, you are brilliant, a brilliant communicator and a brilliant writer. I love what you offer in this book, the Michael Phelps as jockey illustration, in order to expose the utter insanity of the trans narrative. Mm-hmm. Can you recapitulate that for us? Because I think that makes the point as well as anything I've ever heard.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you. Well, Michael Phelps, obviously, we all know him to be this amazing swimmer. And, you know, this thought experiment, what if he had been born and been told he should be a jockey instead? You know, it's much more popular to be a jockey. Why don't you become a jockey? And he's like, well, I've got these long legs. Well, why don't we just cut some of your legs off and put, you know, move your feet to a different place, and then you could be a great jockey. And I think, you know, it helps because it gets out of the confines of thinking about gender in this case. And instead, you're just thinking about the human body. And the area in which we're really going to flourish. And, you know, Michael Phelps should not really ever be near a horse as a jockey. And even if he has his feet moved up, part of his legs removed, it's still not going to make him an amazing jockey. And so, yeah, I think that thinking about it and thinking about these issues and the transitioning that we're doing, the surgeries that we're doing, it helps to look at them in a totally different context and just see the ridiculousness of it, largely based on trends and trendiness and, you know, what's happening and what the culture is dictating to us. So,
and you say the ridiculousness of it, it is ridiculous. And yet you have medical professionals at the top of their professions that are creating vaginas out of penises and penises out of forearms.
Yeah. The forearms and the kind of infections. I mean, this is the other piece that obviously people talk about, but I don't think we talk about enough, is just how lucrative this is. Because, you know, when you create a penis out of a forearm, there's going to be years and years and years of infection and problems that are going to arise from that, because it's not what the forearm skin was made for. You know, all of these kinds of problems are going to be arising. So not only do the hospitals get the money from the initial surgeries, but there's going to be this years and years of care, ultimately until probably an infection or something will kill that person. But it's just incredibly lucrative. You know, it's like $1 million or something for all those years of care for this person that actually didn't medically need any of it. You know, nothing was wrong with this person, but all because, you know, psychologically they've been told that they can do this. That's why it's being done. So until we see a lot more lawsuits, I think, coming from the detransitioners, we're going to continue to see this being pushed through the hospitals because it's making so much money. And of course, Planned Parenthood has now obviously gotten involved in the administering of testosterone. So that's going to be another piece that they keep promoting, because you've got, you know, little girls, the way they used to go get their nails done or something, you know, waltzing into Planned Parenthood and a group of girls for them all to get their testosterone shots. So yeah, it's amazingly lucrative.
And the specter of teen suicide.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, a whole another piece. That's the reason why doctors and psychologists are telling us that people have to do this. Would you rather have your daughter be a boy, or would you rather have your daughter be dead? You know, that's the stark argument that they are making, that that's why we have to do all of this intervention biologically into their bodies so that they won't kill themselves. Again, forgetting to mention that the suicide rates are actually worse after the fact instead of before.
I love the section in the book titled The Way Home. Thank God for that section in the book. But you are candid. You say, if we do not reverse course, and you give evidence for this, it's the end of Western civilization as we know it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, I think, a startling piece. I found the work of J.D. Unwin, who is a sociologist in the 60s, and he talked about how cultures die. You know, we know from Arnold Toynbee, many people know of him as a historian. His famous quote is, "A civilization isn't murdered, it commits suicide." And you can see that in the fall of Rome and, you know, other places very, very easily. But Unwin was interesting because he actually goes through, he was an agnostic. I mean, this was not a man with any kind of religious conviction, but he goes through and basically says, every civilization that has died kind of in the same pattern through this committing of suicide. And he said, when I found this one detail in a civilization, I knew it had about 100 years left. He said, there will be three things from this one detail that will follow. And they are the end of monogamy, the end of faith, and the end of reason. And he said, all of them start when a civilization gets rid of the prohibition against premarital sex. So as soon as premarital sex is allowed and accepted in the culture, then all of those three things will follow. And, you know, it's fascinating. You know, probably if I had read this 50 years ago, I wouldn't have paid much attention. But now when we're seeing that so blatantly in front of us, you know, the absence of faith, the absence of the capacity to reason, of course, the abandonment of monogamy, you know, this man is on to something. Human nature, as much as we try to change it, just isn't really that malleable. And so these are really important things that we, you know, have to keep in mind, and if we can't recapture them, then we really don't have a future in Western civilization the way that we think things can go on. But yeah, incredibly insightful. He also, I think another point that Unwin makes that's really interesting was just talking about how, just from a, you know, an economy of time aspect, part of the reason the devolution happens is because people are spending all this time on things that don't actually build culture. They're wasting time on relationships that aren't going anywhere. They're not having children. They're not focused on doing work that will help their family, all of these kinds of things. And we can see this, you know, certainly in our own culture. We've got these surrogates that we have set out for men and women, you know, between pornography and pets. Women are, and men are finding, you know, other ways to sort of satisfy themselves. But these are not the ways in which culture is built. These are just energy wasters and dissipators. And that was his big point, is that's what happens in the culture, is the energy goes somewhere else instead of to building a future.
Yet, in spite of all of what you have just said, and what I would say you have correctly said and eloquently described, you see glimmers of hope.
Yeah, I think there are glimmers of hope. I think one of the things that makes me really hopeful is this group of women that I call the flyover women, even though we're not, you know, I live on one of the coasts. I don't live in flyover country, but I think it's an attitude about women that the women of the, you know, the mean girls and the elite women in the culture sort of think we don't exist. And to a large effect, we don't even know that we exist because of the fact that we're not in the limelight. We're not in the media. We're not represented with any kind of equality. But what I'm seeing is that there are a lot of women like me who are saying something's wrong. I don't know what it is. You know, they're waking up and they're paying attention. They're really pressing into their motherhood and their relationships with their husband. And they're trying to be better women and, you know, combating all of these things that really are destroying the culture. And so I'm seeing a lot of hope with the fact that these women are realizing that we're not alone anymore. Even groups like Moms for America or Moms for Liberty are doing incredible things. I think that this is sort of follows that pattern of, you know, what Phyllis Schlafly was able to do to stop the ERA back in the 70s. These moms groups are doing great work, and they're also know they're doing the right work because they're being targeted by the Biden administration and the Southern Poverty Law Center. So I think that there's some great hope there, you know, and of course, always there's hope with God. We know that he's forming people, the right people for the right moment. That's something we see throughout history, the different saints that are there to push back against the culture and the evils and the sins of that particular day. So I think that we can have great hope, but much of that really depends on embracing this idea that women are made to be mothers and we're made to live out that vocation. We're made to live within families. We're made to love our husbands. And, you know, it's through that, that's how we step by step rebuild the culture.
And the wonder of motherhood, you save the best for last. But I mean, women have superpowers and so easily willing to reject those superpowers, things that only a woman can do, for a fake dream.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And that was actually the last chapter. I've actually had one friend of mine recently said, you know, I just cried through that whole last chapter because it was after all this awfulness. It was, I think she just, it was so beautiful to start thinking about really these aspects of womanhood that are so denigrated or so ignored or so, you know, we just don't even pay attention to them. We don't know how to look for them anymore. And that was kind of the fun part, was just researching this of, you know, how do we think about women, that even the romance languages, why are there certain things in masculine and feminine? You know, the words for like a river are feminine in many cases, that we carry things, that we improve things. Even, you know, boats are another example of the feminine. This is why a boat always has a woman's name. So it was really fun to look both through, you know, mythology, but also, of course, through scripture at seeing what is it that we are not seeing about women that's so beautiful and vital and full of, like you said, full of wonder that we can start marveling at again. And how do we start creating kind of a new grammar to help women understand these things about ourselves instead of always, you know, pushing us to this masculine and how do we compete with men?
The criticality of genuine gender differentiated parenting is critical. So it's not just the beauty of a woman, which is something that should be focused on, but the need for a woman and a man to raise a family, the family being a central pillar of all of human civilization.
Yeah. No, and I think that that's the amazing thing, is just that complementarity that has been lost. And men don't know how to be men and women don't know how to be women. But you're right, that vitalness. I mean, that's, I guess, you know, I feel so grateful because I had an amazing father. I know amazing men. I have a great husband and brothers and brothers-in-law and, you know, so on. So many of us don't have that, but that's what we have to start rebuilding, is just a context in which people can see this that's obviously been so lost in the culture. You know, just think about the sitcoms that we watch and the commercials that we see, and every man is an idiot. And, you know, the woman has to, she's the savior that helps him figure out how to diaper a baby or something. You know, that kind of attitude. So we have to get back to understanding the real gifts that men and women offer and stop conflating them as if we do the same things, because we clearly don't. And in no way is that better highlighted than when a couple has a child together. And again, because of that vulnerability brings out really the best of us, because it gets us out of our own selfish, narcissistic attitude and takes us, you know, pulls us into something smaller and tinier that needs us, that pulls us, you know, out to being better human beings. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing when we allow it to really be what it is instead of, you know, this deformation that we've been living with.
A final question. My son, David, is in studio, my oldest son, and he always asks the most profound questions. And he just slipped this note to me wanting to ask you, Carrie, our cultural moment is all about redefining terms. If you could redefine and reclaim the term feminism, how would you do it?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think that's been the big debate. I've actually don't think that it can be done. I think people have tried to do it, and I think it's so laden with wreckage. It's almost like asking, can you redefine Nazism? I mean, feminism has been more deadly than Nazism. It's been more deadly than Stalinism. It's been more deadly than Mao. If you look at the number of abortions, we have 72 million just last year alone worldwide. So I think that's a great question. I've asked myself for a long time, and I finally have just decided it's too wrecked. I think we need a new word for being pro-woman. I don't know what that is yet, but I just feel like that.
I hope you coin it.
I'll pray about that. See what comes to mind, but I haven't come up with the right thing yet. But in any event, I think that it's something that people want, and we'll see. Maybe we don't need it. Maybe we just need to, you know, really go back to just understanding humanity and human nature, and then it doesn't become an issue anymore. I'm not sure. So,
well, you are a splendid example of what it means to be a woman. I admire you in so many different ways. You're a terrific writer. The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. This book is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Again, the book, The End of Woman, the cover, that's a story in itself. It is intriguing, to say the least. The title is intriguing. The subtitle is fantastic, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. And Carrie Gress, I'm a big fan. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on Hank Unplugged. Brilliant, insightful. You've blessed us all.
Oh, thank you. It's really been a pleasure to be here with you.
And remember, our mission is to bring the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to you so you can learn from them. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. And thanks so much for tuning into this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. See you next time with more.